the light was on, but it is now.
Okay. Let me open the House Committee on Rural Communities Natural, House Interim Committee on Rural Communities Land Use and Water today, September 28th. And our first order of business should be to welcome everybody. Welcome, colleagues. I hope you all had a good summer. I, like you, probably didn't miss each other or this building that much. It's probably a little early to be back already, but I am happy to see you. And
thank you.
With that, how about we get to having some rules for this committee?
Chair Clem, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 28th, 2015.
Vice Chair Post moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 28th, 2015. Is there any discussion? Representative McClain.
Having not read them, are there any substantive changes?
No.
Over session?
Representative, there are not.
Okay. Thank you.
Trusting Beth's word, because I haven't read them either quite yet. Any further discussion?
I actually read them.
We have one life, eager beaver. Okay. Seeing none, the clerk, please call the roll.
Rep Gilliam?
Excused.
Rep Gomber?
Aye.
Rep McClain?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Excused.
Vice Chair Helm?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Clem?
Aye. Motion passes. Rules are adopted. Okay, colleagues, I'm going to move one item up a little bit just because they've got a long drive in this morning and have something back this evening. That's the Eastern Oregon folks on the board and to Hemingway Transmission Line Project Update. So what I would like to do is ask our first panel to come up. We've got two panels. So Bob, Craig, and Don, do you want to come up? And you may or may not remember this. We had a proposed amendment to some other bill relating to agriculture, and we didn't end up gutting and stuffing or adding it in. But we did have a conversation at that time about a proposed power line in Eastern Oregon.
Yes.
And we heard a little bit about it from the farmers, the utilities, you know, about maybe some options for which way they could go with it that would bring either more or less comfort to the parties involved, because it's kind of a challenge for either side no matter which way you go. And we're hoping to hear about maybe a solution that everybody would like, but I want to give you an update on that, because I wasn't sure people would remember the it was never a bill, it was a potential amendment to a bill that we didn't do. So anyway, that's the background on our guests today. So whoever would like to start, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Reeder. I work for Hale Farms, an Eastern Oregon farmer, and am a member of an ad hoc committee that was formed of landowners that are potentially impacted from the Boardman to Hemingway and other transmission lines in our area. And so there's three key points that I'd like to make this morning. I'll kind of spare you the details. I guess the first point is that we have a conundrum in our area, and that is that we have two very sure projects on the table right now excuse me that involve material transmission lines. And one's a dual circuit 230 line, and one's a 500 line, which is the Boardman to Hemingway line. So equal size, equal impact, and they're both trying to get down the same corridor, and that's created some consternation from us. My first key point is that in the absence of a naval easement, $20-plus million of high-value ag land will need to be condemned with just these two projects that are on the table today. And so just a little bit of the lay of the land, this is this is the Naval Bombing Range, which is a 50,000-acre tract of ground in our area, and just to the east of that lays Bombing Range Road. And the new proposed connection point for our area is what's called the Longhorn Substation, which will be located right here. That will be an attraction point for hundreds of millions of dollars worth of wind energy in southern Morrow and Umatilla County and the Boardman to Hemingway project. And so they are both trying to get to, right now there's only one wind project, and Boardman Hemingway trying to get to this connection point, but that wind project is 500 megawatts, and they think there's between 1,500 and 2,000 megawatts of power in the South County that's going to need to get to this same connection point. So it is and will be an ongoing issue.
Okay,
yes, sir.
Just real quick, could you say again the acres you said at the beginning of farmland? I just thought
so
I would write that down.
In the irrigated area that you see on that map is 180,000 irrigated acres. The naval bombing range represents 50,000 acres in the heart of what could be additional irrigated ground.
Thank you.
And irrigation is a
on the just the
out there we know.
Yeah. And that's just on the Oregon side of the river.
Okay.
Sorry.
So the second point is that we need help with the Navy in attaining a repurpose of an easement. So in the absence of this easement, like I said, either one of the two utilities will have to condemn irrigated property on the east side of the road to get to the connection point, as will any additional wind project or future wind projects will need to condemn property to get to that same Longhorn connection point as well. So we have one of the proponents of one of the lines, Idaho Power, has made application to the Navy for a very important nuance in this is a repurpose of an existing easement. So not a new easement, but the repurpose of an existing easement there that which would allow their larger line to go in over top of an existing BPA line and include that BPA line. So it's not asking for any increase in the footprint. It's asking for just a simple repurpose of an existing easement to accommodate the request. So we're going to need some help. That has been requested, but of course that's a federal action. And the Navy, with all due respect to national security and all of the tremendous benefits they provide on stuff like a repurpose of an easement is not exactly, I would assume, their highest priority nor something that they move relatively quickly on. So making sure and help with that easement is something that we definitely need. The last point is that we need support for those who have condemnation authority to stay the course on the existing Navy easement. The Boardman to Hemingway project is something that's been on the docket since 2007. It's an important project, and with respect to our communities, our community does want the Longhorn substation, they want the wind power, and they'd like the Boardman-Hemingway line to come to the Longhorn substation. We do have a fix on the table that is good, but it's going to need a Navy easement, and it's going to need patience on those who want to get to that connection point and want to get that connection point constructed. It's going to need patience on them to make sure that we run that trap line, if you will, with the Navy. So those are the three points that I would make, and what we the request that we have, and Don and Bob will expand a little bit on it more. The request that we have is that we help provide some accountability, not only the Navy but also the people that have condemnation authority, to make sure that we stay the course and make the best fit, the best fix for our community, which is one big line up one side of the road and one big line up the other side of the road, and most importantly, some corridor planning for that, which is yet to come. Thank you for your time.
Okay, why don't you all go first, and then we'll do questions for all three at once, if that's all right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Great. For the record, Don Rice with Greenwood Resources, Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair and members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to be here today. As Craig has said, there's multiple needs to go through that corridor. He listed the two primary needs. There are current uses and needs that need to be maintained through that area as well. There's been a lot of effort put in by local people as stakeholders and the UMT Electric Co-op, and Idaho Power has pitched in and been cooperative in trying to figure out a cumulative solution to all the multiple needs. So in addition to the two, there's three other local needs that are currently in those corridors, and UMT Electric and Idaho Power have done a nice job of creating an engineering solution to minimize the impacts. But as Craig has said, it's all contingent upon being able to repurpose the route through the Navy and being able to place one of the new big lines on that side of the road. And so there's the Idaho Power has made application to the Navy for to be able to use that side, and I don't have all the latest. Idaho Power can give us the latest here later in terms of their discussions with the Navy. But my understanding is the Navy has a requirement that before they would consider repurposing that no other alternatives are available. And according to the draft environmental impact statement that was produced with a lot of erroneous information about the impacts on agriculture. It lists a route through the ag land as a viable alternative. And so unless there's some help in convincing the Navy that's not a viable alternative to condemn the agricultural land, they can say there's an alternative and they don't need to consider a repurposing of the easement. So we need some help in pushing that easement discussion along with the Navy. And the state's been a participant in some of these cumulative impacts discussions, and we need just a strong statement from the state to help us protect the irrigated agricultural areas. Did you have more slides you want me to go through, or is that all?
No, I think that's... That's the potential impact area of both lines being located on one side of the road, and that red line represents about $30 million worth of irrigated ground that would be placed out of production. And this is ground that's located, it's irreplaceable because of its proximity not only to the river, but also its proximity to the second largest port in the state and the value-added infrastructure inside the port. And so.
So this red line is what, if you read the draft environmental impact statement, this is the way it's described. There is support from the parties, Umatilla Electric, Idaho Power, to reduce that impact if they do have to go on the east side. So this is kind of a worst case situation as it's currently drafted in the impact statement. But there's a cooperation, but the best choice is if we can use that Navy easement side and almost eliminate the red line.
The same line, just the other side of the road, basically.
Right.
Vice Chair Helm.
Just a quick question. Are each of those circles a standard pivot?
Yes.
And could you give us an idea of the variation of crops that are grown in?
Well, I would speak to the squares rather than the circles. Okay. The squares is more than a tree farm.
Yeah.
And Craig, circles.
So it's the best irrigated vegetable ground in the world, literally, one of two places. And so you have a myriad of both traditional commodity crops and vegetables, peas, sweet corn, grass seed, carrots, potatoes, onions, just about anything other than citrus crops we can grow up there and grow relatively well. And we have value-added processing infrastructure within a 20-mile radius of this specific ground. Now, I guess one clarifying point on this, that this isn't anybody's preferred option. You know, this is the result of what hand would be forced if the Navy didn't grant the easement. So it's important to clarify that Idaho Power and UEC have both worked really hard and really well with us here in the recent future to develop the fix to this. So this is, if the Navy doesn't allow it, it would force the Boardman to Hemingway line to go out in, you know, into some potential condemnation property. So this is what we're trying to avoid. However, we don't have the naval easement in hand, and, you know, that's something that one of our asks, that we need some help attaining that easement. So, Bob.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Bob Levy. I'm from Hermiston, Oregon. I'm a farmer there. I think I'd like to back up for just a minute. I'm going to show you something on this map, and then we're going to back up to the first one. This process has taken too long. It's been too expensive, and it's taken too many attorneys and too much emotional stress on landowners to try to figure out how we interact in this process because of a lack of policy direction. And it's not just state policy, but there's some federal policy problems too. So the original line that we were so concerned about was one that went through this tree farm. There's a dairy right there now. This is an older picture. There's a dairy right there now. There's a dairy here, and the line went like it made a zigzag around it and then down this way and then to Longhorn. And that's of no fault of Idaho Power or the applicant. It has to do with just the way they made the application to BLM, and BLM picked this route, and that happened to be it. So you can see it again on this map, it's this route right here, and that's all to get to Longhorn. The important thing to, and we didn't know any of this when we started, so I'm kind of going back a ways in time. We didn't understand when we started this process that everybody has to get to Bonneville. Bonneville's the purple line. That's the line that if you drive from, if you cross the Umatilla River at McNary, or at Umatilla, McNary Dam's right there. That's the substation that you saw the first picture of. It's where all the lines come together. There's another place way down the line called Slat, where down by Arlington, Biggs Junction, where other lines all come together, and you'll see some of them going to California if you drive down towards Redmond and Bend. So everybody's got to get to these purple lines. I don't know of any way around it, because that's kind of the corridor out of the area. This, and you may hear Idaho Power talk about this later, but Longhorn is going to eventually apparently be the trading hub for the Mid-Sea power transfer of power, which will occur across the western United States. Currently, and I could be a bit over the tips of my skis, but currently there are power lines planned by large conglomerates to connect the western U.S. so that power can be transferred from California to Oregon or Wyoming. Idaho Power, Pacific Core, all those are parts of that. Just so you'll know, we do support the access of wind projects to the grid or any other need that people have to get to the grid. We just think that there's a lack of planning with regards to several parts of it. So that's the McNary substation, or McNary where the lines come together. That's kind of what we're trying to avoid. Okay. There was, when we started this project, 8 wind projects in Umatilla and Morrow County that were trying to figure out how to get to the grid. This is a picture of from Morrow County of the current siting of MET towers. So where every one of these MET towers is, that's somebody who's gathering data to try to figure out if there's enough wind to get their project defined and define the location of their actual wind turbines. They then design the lines between the turbines, and then they try to figure out a way to get to the grid. This is significant. This is more wind power in total than we currently have in a large part of the development. So this is a big deal.
This is, for reference, this is the bombing range right there.
Yeah.
And the other big push in the area, too, that this doesn't represent is solar power. We have about 400 megawatts of solar power also in Umatilla Morrow County, and that's also starting to be more prevalent.
Like Craig said, for reference, the bombing range is 50,000 acres, so you can see how many acres this map represents. It's a significant number of acres. Most everything that's south of what you see that's pink and south of the bombing range is dryland farming and rangeland. So wind towers don't affect that stuff nearly. So we talked for just a minute about the lack of a policy, and this is a map that we generally see with a wind project, and I'm sure that Todd will cover a little bit more about this later, but this map or picture shows what we call the Wheat Ridge Wind Project, and it happens to be where these lines are here and then these lines. This part of it here, you can see the Umatilla County line. So part of this project is in Umatilla County line, or in Umatilla County. Part of it is in Morrow County. The big part of it's in Morrow County. Again, the bombing range, and then you can remember there was all those wind MET towers out here. So this map is one that when we see it, from a landowner perspective, it's not too alarming because you don't really know how the project is going to get to the grid. We don't think it's necessary in the FSEC process to identify how the wind project is going to get to the grid. It comes later in the process.
That's currently the case?
Yeah, you can ask Todd to make sure that's correct, but that's our understanding. So once again, this wind project has to figure out a way to get over here by the Columbia River to hook on to the Bonneville line. So I think there might be one other. Is there one other slide? No, okay. So this is the, there's one map that's, or one picture that's a little clearer, but this is the current way that the Wheat Ridge, and this is certainly not their part fault, they have followed the rules.
This is a zoom in for reference. This is a zoom in of this section of the Wheat Ridge project. So this is Hermiston right here, and this is Highway 207. So this right here, that orange is this chunk of purple right there. And so the pink dot are the lines he's going to, and blue dot are the lines he's going to talk about.
Okay.
So the project's got to get to the grid. So now they're starting to try to figure out how to do it. This, a similar map to this was also included in their 2013 application to FSEC, but the map is not required to be sent to landowners. So the landowners that we're going to talk about in a minute are the ones that are now on the Gentile lines, the lines that tie the wind project to the grid. They have identified several alternatives.
So they leave the... Hey, Bob, go back one second. So you said when you see this, that's not that alarming. And is it because the...
It's not alarming because it doesn't show where the line's going to go that's connect the wind project to the grid.
What about the people underneath all that? That looks like what happens when I try and draw a cat. That's what that looks like, actually. So underneath that tail over there on the right, which is my cat tail, all that sprawl, scraggly lines everywhere. What about the people underneath that? Are they alarmed, or it's not irrigated, so not as alarmed?
Those people are generally all under contract with the wind developer. So this, where these wind towers are going to go, they're under contract with the wind developer. They usually get like a couple bucks an acre until the project is completed, and then once the project is completed, they get a payment based on the power that's developed. So
the price is right, it might be worth it to have a bunch of lines on your land that you can work around.
Oh, there's no question. Each tower, the old number was about $10,000 per wind tower is what the landowner gets.
Annually.
Annually. Now with the new bigger wind towers, then the payments are more.
Yeah. Okay.
If you can get a power purchase contract.
Okay.
All right, so then the way that they've defined this to get to the grid, this pink line is one alternative. There are currently no power lines on that route. That's through circle irrigated farming ground. There's no power line there. There's two power lines on this road, one on each side of the highway, that's Butter Creek Highway, that were not considered as an alternative. This line, again, there's a small Umatil Electric line on this route, but no big line. Now, this line is, if this ends up being a 500 kV line or a dual 230, this is a big power line. This is as big as you can see. This line here is another alternative that is also through irrigated agriculture land with no current power line except a small one that serves local communities. When it gets down here, it gets really confusing. They're not quite sure how they're going to get to what has been identified as the Stanfield substation, which is yet to be built by Bonneville and is fairly close to the new Umatilla County Fairgrounds Eastern Oregon Event and Trade Center that's being moved.
In the airport.
Yeah, in the airport. This route right here goes over six homes that are along that road. All of these lines have out here have major impact to the landowners. This line up here zigzags around, stays just right outside of the Stanfield city limits, so they don't have to comply with the municipal rules. And then they end up over here somewhere at the Stanfield substation.
Bob, one sec. Representative McLean has a question.
Bob, is the choice to connect to the Bonneville on this side of that array or his ugly cat, or on the other side through the bombing road? Is it one or the other, or both?
Both.
So you have to connect on both sides of that?
I'm sorry, Representative Clem. There's two alternatives for hooking up the wind power. One would be at the Stanfield substation, hook part of it up there. The other alternative would be to hook all or part of it up to Longhorn by Boardman.
All right, so may I follow up? So what you're showing here is that if we go away from the bombing road into here, we've got lots of problems.
The real problem comes with the other seven wind projects. Where are they going to go?
Even so, if we do bombing road.
Yeah, I mean, this one goes in, then there's, you know, you can look on the BPA queue list, which is a list of the wind projects that want to get to the grid, and you can see how many there are. They come and go on the list, because when you get on the Bonneville list, you have to start paying money. Sometimes they get to the point where they stop paying money and they get off the list, and then other people get on the list.
I mean,
and this is not Wheat Ridge's problem. This is generally a problem in our area. How are we going to plan for long-term planning to get to the grid?
So this is why you're advocating a policy being set at the state level on how this is done?
That, and that we would like to see the FSEC applications provide for access to the grid in the original application, how they're going to do it, the conceptual lines. What happens is when we see the wind project identified and there's no way to get to the grid, no identified way to get to the grid, then the wind project gets approved. Then we start facing the problem of condemnation to get to the grid. And that's where the landowners then come in late in the process.
All right. Thank you.
So let's do this. Let's not spend – we will come back to the larger policy issues, but we've got a bunch of other people on other topics. And so let's just spend a little bit more time on policy on other things. And I want to get to questions from them about Bombing Range Road specifically, because I've authored bills on pipelines on farmland. Other people have too. It's a bigger topic that is important for us to look at. I just don't want to try and rush it here when we really want to focus in on the Boardman to Hemingway Bombing Range Road ask and get the other folks' kind of comments on that as well. But we will come back to it, I promise you. You'll just have to drive all the way back over sometime, sorry.
No worries. Yeah, there's three, to your point, there's three, and to clarify, Representative McLean, your inquiry, there's three things that were, and one of them's an immediate need. Those three things are, you know, help in getting the naval easement put in place, because we have inside of the compromise plan that we've put together, we have planned for additional capacity for wind projects in Morrow County. So we've tried to put together an ad hoc corridor plan for the Longhorn substation going in and additional wind and Boardman to Hemingway in the plan that we're talking about. So the immediate need, item one, is that we need help in getting the naval easement. Whatever assistance the administration or your body can help us, you know, say that this is a key part to our economy to get that naval easement repurposed. That's our first ask. The second ask, and the last two asks are more long term, is some sort of policy on the corridor planning. I mean, with the coal states, if you will, pressure on coal, and they're going to need to get to this power grid. They're going to need to get to the Northwest power grid. And also with rural economies, with wind and solar coming in and a focus on renewals, they're going to need to get to the power grid. And the primary, what stands between the power grid and those other entities needing to get to the power grid is high-value irrigated egg ground and permanent crops. And so that's our third ask. The second ask being some policy on corridor planning. And the third ask then is some protection for the high-value ag ground. You know, right now, high-value ag ground is considered by soil class. For us, the worse the soil, the sandier the soil, the better it is for irrigated agriculture. So we lose from the standpoint that the only true item right now, policy that quantifies or classifies high value of ground is the soil type, and that puts us at a disadvantage. So being able to clarify the policy on high-value ag ground, high-value irrigated ag ground, and permanent crops it would be our third ask. So, but to clarify what you are.
Craig, I'd like to close just with one more.
One second.
Go ahead.
One more question. Here.
Craig, have you talked with the governor's office or regional solutions folks, or do they have a task assigned?
Yes, Representative Clinton. We're actually meeting with some people from the governor's staff on creating a task force. We would have preferred that the task force would have been up and running by now to assist with this process. But the good news is that it looks like that task force is coming together, it's going to be the purpose of that task force is going to be around the corridor planning and the policy piece on things. So yeah, we are getting some assistance from the governor's office, very much so.
Thanks. Yeah, I was looking back. I remember this. It's a law, actually. It wasn't just a bill. House Bill 3153 from 09. It requires utility providers to consult record owner of high-value farmland for purpose of locating, constructing transmission line in manner that minimizes impact, but it is high-value farmland.
Defined by soil class.
And it doesn't necessarily, push you to other locations. It's just consult with you on where, on your place, where would be the best place. And maybe how deep and that kind of stuff, which was a start. But I remember at the time people wanting to talk about things like, well, how much are we going to get paid in the bill? And, you know, and there's certainly nothing about, and if there's some other alternative option, let's try and make that happen. So I see your point, but again, probably not for today, for much more discussion on that. But it's an ongoing topic. You wanted to finish, Bob, right?
I'd like to just close with kind of a practical example. You can't build a home without showing how you have access to the county road or to a public road. It doesn't make any sense that you're going to build a great big wind project without showing how you're going to get to the grid or proposed routes in the initial application. Thank you very much.
Okay, questions? The one I have, since the Navy's not here, is a pretty, I think, obvious one. But when you hear bombing and high-powered 500-volt lines, you wonder about that. So what do we know about that?
Well,
put it on their side of the road. How do we not bomb it?
Chair Clam, the Navy has specifications for height. They use the bombing range for some low elevation flying practice, and so they've put in a flight corridor. They put a height restriction of 100 feet on the towers, and Idaho Power and UEC have come up with designs that allow them for that flight corridor, flight path, to stay under the specification that the Navy has identified.
Yeah, now I think about it, they're not bombing anywhere near the road anyway. They're way out in the middle.
And they're not dropping bombs.
They're
anymore.
Actually not light bombs. It's more laser, laser type stuff. And low altitude flying is the main entree there. Okay. They fly up the gorge and then target shoot out over the bombing range.
So you don't have to dodge bombs while you're driving up that road or anything.
No, we get a pretty good air show now and again too. Okay. So. And then,
well, I'm glad for that. I like you guys.
The last thing, if I may, Mr. Chairman, is that I don't want it to look like that there's a bunch of infighting amongst our region. We have, over the last couple of months, come together. Unfortunately, this landowners group has had to spend about $250,000, trying to find our way through this thing and manage our risks, which we, again, don't believe should be necessary in this process. But I do want to make a special mention on where we're at today. And where we're at today is we have a compromise position that is a really good piece piece of business for our region and will accommodate future wind development, Representative McLean, to your point. So we have a good fix on the table. We just need some help short-term getting across the finish line, and if the Navy doesn't come through with an easement, then we will have a literal generational wound in our area. And then the policy piece comes in so that hopefully nobody will have to go through what we've had to go through again. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, I can assure you that having been involved in pipeline hearings, this is pretty tame. You didn't fill the room with people angry, hell no, we're not doing anything, don't go through our land. I've seen those.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is pretty pleasant.
Not yet, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we've got a good fix, so if we can get that Navy easement, we'll be in good shape. So, thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're not hearing from the Navy. Do we have any cause to be concerned, or are we?
We're not hearing from the Navy, but we are going to hear from some folks who probably talk to the Navy more often than we do about from Oregon Department of Energy, the Governor's Office, and Idaho Power. And so let's ask them that, too, because they're the closest we're going to get probably to communication with the Navy.
I'd be curious whether the high energy field that would be established would in any way interfere with the avionics, any of those planes.
Okay, so Mitch, Margie, and Todd, do you want to come up? And this is not like a for and against panel. I just had three, so I put I had three and three. But so Mitch is with Idaho Power. Do you want to talk a little bit about first, and then we'll go into the state's view as well? Welcome, first of all.
Sure. Thank you for the invitation, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mitch Colburn. I'm with Idaho Power Company. I am the lead of our 500 KV projects group based out of Boise, Idaho. And so I'm here just to share some information about our project, where we are to date, and where we're going to be going forward. So the Boardman to Hemingway line, actually a pretty good introduction by Mr. Rice, Mr. Levy, and Mr. Reeder. B2H line is a 500 kV transmission line from northern Oregon, from the Boardman, Oregon area, to southwestern Idaho. It's about 300 miles long. It runs through five counties in Oregon, one county in Idaho. Total cost is estimated at $1 to $1.2 billion, and we've been in the permitting process since 2008. We have two permitting partners in PacifiCorp and Bonneville Power Administration. So Idaho Power is the lead on permitting, but we're actually the minority interest in the project on a percentage basis. We started in 2008, and Bonneville Power and PacifiCorp joined permitting in 2012. So we've been working together going forward. So why the Boardman to Hemingway project? So Idaho Power kicked it off, really came out of a 2006 planning process. We've been working on it since then. Primarily, it's a load-serving resource for us. The Pacific Northwest is a resource flush. The Pacific Northwest traditionally experiences their peak load in the winter, and the Intermountain West region traditionally experiences peak load in the summer. So there's a resource diversity, and there's opportunity to, speaking for the Intermountain West, to go to the Pacific Northwest in the summer and access low-cost energy, and vice versa. You know, in the winter, there's opportunity to transport electricity from the Intermountain West to the Pacific Northwest. So there's regional diversity to take advantage of. The existing system between those two regions is fully utilized. There's no more capacity. So hence a new line between the regions. PacifiCorp and Bonneville Power's needs are very similar. It's a low-cost option or low-cost resource in the future to serve load. So it's about serving customers and identifying the most cost-effective way to serve those customers. Other benefits of the project. We talked previously about some of the renewable development in the region, and you need a transmission system there to connect renewables. You know, there's not one without the other. And so adding more bulk transmission infrastructure will facilitate further renewable development. We say the B2H project is a no-carbon resource in that it's an alternative to building a power plant. You know, we're utilizing existing generation in the region, so it's better utilization of what we have today. It'll increase reliability of the system, and that's, I wanted to highlight the Obama administration identified the Boardman to Hemingway project of one of seven national transmission projects that he identified as priority projects, in that they bring jobs to the economy, they help integrate renewables, they provide low-cost resources to customers and add reliability. So I wanted to provide a routing history. As we said, we started in 2008, and this graphic here shows the initial routes in 2008. Didn't take us long into the process before we realized that stakeholder involvement was not going to be sufficient. We talked previously that this is a, we've been working through two permitting processes. The federal process is led by the BLM, and there's also the state process, which Todd will talk more about. But the federal process was not going to be sufficient from a public stakeholder involvement. So it didn't take us long into the process before we basically put permitting on pause and said, you know, we need to work with the communities. Idaho Power identifying a route that we think minimizes impacts is not going to be sufficient to the stakeholders in these communities. So we kicked off what we called the community advisory process, the CAP process as we call it, where we worked with local communities to identify routes, to really have the communities put routes on the table. And this graphic here is from 2010. This is a point in the community advisory process where we had almost 50 different route variations on the table. And this is all through the CAP process. So what we did is we took those community developed routes and brought them back into the BLM process, brought the preferred route back in, and this is the route you'll see. This is from the BLM's draft environmental impact statement, and what you see in red is the proposed route, the project proposed route, with some of the blue being different variations of, or alternatives to a proposed route. And it's kind of hard to see, but there's a green. My clicker isn't cooperating with me. There's a green shading, and that represents the BLM's agency preferred. So at the end of the day, we're going to get to, hopefully, we're going to get to an environmental impact statement where we'll have an agency preferred route. And that's what I'll get to here in a second. So really where we are today, you know, the project partnerships between three very large utilities, Pacific Core, Bonneville Power Administration, Idaho, really prove the point that this is a very significant regional project, very expensive, very significant regional project. It's been a long process to date. We've spent roughly $68 million in the permitting process, and we still don't have a permit yet. But really that's kind of where I'd like to leave us, is that we think we're close. We have the draft environmental impact statement that came out last year, and by all accounts, it appears that a final record of decision is expected late next year for the federal process. So we think we're at a good place. I'd like to just talk real quick to the Navy decisions and what I know of the Navy decision. So it's basically a three-part process for an easement application. So we submitted an easement application on June 22nd, and the first decision point is a decision on operational impacts. So the Navy has to determine, does this line impact their existing operations? And our arguments are that there's an existing line there today. We are taking that line out and putting a new line in its place. We meet the height restrictions. We're not, we're staying within the same width of the existing easement, and we have support, you know, community support for this, in that we feel that it really minimizes impacts to the area, to the agriculture interest in particular. So Yes, we're looking for as much support as we can get, looking for a decision from the Navy. Really no indication at this point one way or another. We're being told late fall is the latest indication we've heard for a decision. And really once the decision on operational impacts is made, then if it's acceptable, we proceed down environmental analysis and then easement terms. So really it'd fall in place a lot more clear after the operational impacts decision. But just want to echo that it's been a long road. We think we're at a good place today. We've really done our best to work with the communities. Certainly there was probably some hiccups early on, but it's been a learning process for us all. But we think we're at a good place and looking towards a federal decision next year. Thank you.
So the naval easement request went in a couple months ago, is that what you said, June?
Yes, we submitted a full application in June. We actually submitted an application late last year or early this year for a new easement, not repurposing an easement, trying to go west of the existing easement. And that application was denied.
Mm. That's good to know. So tried going a little further west of the existing one? No. So how about we repurpose?
Correct.
Well, we certainly appreciate I think of myself from the ag side, but that's, I shouldn't only, but the efforts to try and work to find something there, whether new or repurposing, because I'm sure repurposing costs some money too and gives up something. Yeah. Okay. So either Todd or Margie, whoever you like.
Chair. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the Assistant Director for Siting at the Oregon Department of Energy. Can you actually, that's yours. Is there another one?
Here.
Yeah, the flow chart.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. So I provided an overview, which gave you the timeline of the project. This is just our handout that we provide, which gives you an overview of the overall energy facility siting process. So as Mitch talked about, there's two full processes that are being undertaken by Idaho Power. So they have to go through the full NEPA process through the BLM. They have to go through the full Energy Facility Siting Council process through the state. The applicant is required to meet all of the standards for both processes. So this is where we need to work in conjunction as much as possible with the BLM. So some of the standards, they're not 100% aligned. So we've been working very hard with the BLM to make sure that ultimately whatever routing they come up with is something that's approvable through the Energy Facility Siting Council process. Obviously for the BLM side, they have certain requirements and evaluations. And again, we've tried to make sure that they're aware, you know, such as ag, that's a much more significant issue in our process than it is in their process. And we've tried to communicate to them that ultimately, if they come up with a route that we can't approve, that doesn't serve anybody's purposes. So best to have those conversations as we're going through. But to get into the timeline, Mitch talked about their original notice of intent was submitted in August of 2008. They submitted their preliminary application in February of 2013. And we're still in that same situation. So you can see we are right here, the application for site certificate. So the application came in. We started to review it to determine whether it was complete or not. And Idaho Power requested that we hold off on moving forward on that because of the routing issues through the federal process. The BLM was looking at different route alternatives, and the significant difference of trying to run two parallel processes on the federal and state side is, within our process, when you submit an application, there is a much higher level of detailed survey information that's required than at the NEPA level when they're just looking at some different route alternatives. So it made the most sense for Idaho Power to
hold off and wait for some of those route alternatives to go away in the federal process before they come back in, submit a revised preliminary application to us with all of the required information in our process. And so that's where we're at right now, is they're trying to finalize some of those route alternatives before they come back in with their revised preliminary application to us. We're expecting that in second quarter of 2016. And then we will kick back off on our process, review it for completeness, go through our evaluation of whether the application meets all the state standards or not, and then go through the remainder of the process, which I've talked to this committee and other committees about. So I'd be happy to answer questions about our process, but that's generally where we're at right now, is we're sort of waiting for that to happen. In the meantime, Idaho Power is moving forward. They're trying to work on their application so that when they are ready to submit, it's as good an application as possible. So we're going through what we call a draft exhibit review. Well, they will submit draft portions of the application to us. We will evaluate it. We will work with state agencies and local governments to determine if they have submitted as much information as they need ultimately for the application to be complete. So that's where we're at right now. And I'd be happy to answer any questions on this.
Let's go ahead and have Margie. Sure.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Margie Hoffman. I'm Governor Kate Brown's energy policy advisor, and just want to say thank you for making time to talk about this issue here today. I want to talk about two different efforts that the governor's office is engaged in. One is related to the Boardman-Hemingway project, and the other is related to potential cumulative impacts of energy development on this piece of high-value agricultural land in the Umatilla Basin. As the farmers talked about earlier today, this is a huge economic engine for the state due to the capacity to irrigate this area. And I want to say it's very important to us that we minimize any potential impacts due to energy development on these lands. At the same time, you know, Port of Morrow, there are energy needs in the Umatilla Basin. There are wind development opportunities. There's also the Port of Morrow. There's the Umatilla Electric Co-op and some other electric cooperatives up there. And then the need to add capacity to the transmission system, whether that comes from this area or for other areas, so that we can make sure that as load increases in the region, we have the capacity on the transmission line to serve that load. So the first effort related to the Boardman to Hemingway project, as Mitch talked about earlier, the Obama administration had prioritized a number of linear projects throughout the United States because of the need to add capacity to transmission lines. One of them was Boardman to Hemingway. So the Department of Interior, I want to say probably 2.5 years ago, came out to the Pacific Northwest and established what's called the Pacific Northwest Regional Infrastructure Team. You may also hear about, you may hear it referred to as PNRIT, the acronym. The Pacific Northwest Regional Infrastructure Team, the intent of that body is to get together federal decision makers and state decision makers in related to linear projects so that we can identify challenges with siting early and start to work through those challenges together outside of the federal NEPA process. There were two priority projects that were identified. One is a transmission line Vantage to Pomona Heights. The other is Boardman to Hemingway. The people that sit at that table are Idaho, Washington, and Oregon governor's offices, impact relevant agencies at the federal level, whether that's U.S. Fish and Wildlife, Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service, whoever is part of the federal permitting processes for either of those two projects, and then the state agencies that have issues with some of the line routes. I want to point out also that this is not this east side, west side of Bombing Range Road, Longhorn, not Longhorn, is not the only issue with this transmission line. We also have to work through other natural resource issues at different parts of the line, and also archaeological resource, potential archaeological impacts as well. So it's a long line with a lot of issues. But we are very proactively working through those. Through that Pacific Northwest Regional Infrastructure Team process, we have gotten the community, the Bonneville Power, the three line developers, Idaho Power, Bonneville Power, Pacificor, the two counties, Morrow and Umatilla County, some of the local electric cooperatives that would be impacted by replacing a 69 kV line with a 500 kV line. The Navy is at that table as well. We've also gotten the two senators for Oregon, Senators Merkley and Wyden, and also the Idaho delegation to try to find out more information from the Navy about how exactly we go through the process to determine whether or not there is an operational impact with the line route on the west side of Bombing Range Road. And I would say, to Mitch's point earlier, it has been sometimes rocky and sometimes not, but I feel like it's been a very good process to get as much alignment across stakeholders as we possibly can to choose a route that will minimize impacts to this area. The other thing I want to briefly discuss is cumulative impacts. Boardman to Hemingway is not the only, as you saw on the map earlier, it's not the only proposed transmission line project. It's not the only energy project out there. So the governor has convened an advisory committee to look at economic development, energy, and agricultural needs in the Umatilla Basin to bring all of the stakeholders together to talk about Wheat Ridge, to talk about the other proposed wind farms out there, to talk about the market for energy, what energy needs we're going to have in the state and in the region, and how those might be met, and what we can do to help better protect this area. So look forward to working with you, keeping you informed on that process, and happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the most exciting thing about wind this morning is that, to your question, is that they don't have irrigated land. My question is, realistically, can any of you comment on how much wind we're using? What's its contribution to the grid? And realistically, what's its potential?
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, I'm going to I can't answer that specific question for you today. So there are other states in this region that have renewable portfolio standards, which create markets for renewable energy. We also have the Federal Clean Power Plan, which creates targets for reduction of carbon emissions or greenhouse gas emissions from existing natural gas and coal-fired power plants. So there are policies that are happening right now or that are being implemented right now that impact resource needs, but that's exactly the kind of question that we want to work through as part of the advisory committee process to identify what are the power needs in the region. And how are we going to meet those needs? And where's that power going to come from? And you also have to project forward. I mean, Idaho Power has been working on this line for 10 years. So we look very far into the future to figure out how is load going to grow across the region, across Idaho, Montana, Washington, and Oregon. And as that load grows, how are we going to meet that? We look at planning both on a regional basis and then through utility by utility. They all put together long-term energy plans to figure out how they're going to, as data centers move in, where's that power going to come from? Indoor agriculture, electric vehicles. Those are some of the things that we're going to increase load. And hopefully more economic development as well.
Just a quick question, Margie. You said about the governor putting together a task force. Was there a date on that?
Yeah, so I actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Post, my apologies. I haven't ever done this before. So
I'm drawing cats up here. We're not that formal.
I was actually typing an email at my desk when Chair Clem switched the agenda around. So the email with the doodle poll will go out today to the advisory committee members. I'm hoping to shoot for sometime next week in Boardman-ish area.
And will you forward that to us?
Sure can. Happy to.
Let's drive to Boardman.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. This is really helpful for us. Obviously, I think, you know, committee members love win-win solutions, so I don't know that we can just summon the Navy here and convince them either, but if we can think of a way to help, we'd certainly be happy to.
We do have a JAG.
Yeah. Can you, like, with the cell phone and the gavel, do something?
I try often.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. So why don't we have are Mark McMullen and Josh. This is our Rural Oregon presentation.
No, maybe I wasn't supposed to read it.
And now that Representative Helms out of the room, you'll notice there's some water and some rural and no land use, which I thought all of you would particularly enjoy.
Oh.
There was one who might have wanted some land use, but he didn't tell me, so I just ignored it.
Good.
That's kind of what I thought. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name's Mark McMullen. I'm the state economist with the Office of Economic Analysis, joined by my colleague, Josh Lehner. And today I'm going to give a quick update on the rural economy in Oregon, and then Josh is going to follow with some comments and work he's been doing about housing affordability across the state. So in addition to my comments today, we've provided you a short three-page report that we've put together. It's really a collection of some of our talking points on the regional economies across Oregon. Many of them will echo what I told this group last year at this time, as well as the Senate group. So a lot of this will be familiar. Also included at the end of the report are some numbers for those of you interested in the numbers, some data on the different regions in Oregon and how the recent performance of the economies have gone. And in terms of that, there's been some pretty darn good news that things are really starting to improve across the state, even in some of our hardest hit areas. The first chart I'm showing is job. It has to do with employment and how it's performed over the business cycle, and the experience during the recession really was the same in terms of urban and rural Oregon. Job losses were similar across the state, but the recovery certainly has not been the same, where it only in the last year and a half or so have we started to see improvement in rural Oregon. But that last year has been a good one, and we've started to see some really good gains broad-based across the state. Now, obviously, putting this in perspective, the urban areas of the state have regained all the jobs they lost during the recession, whereas the typical rural area in Oregon has only earned back one out of three of the jobs that was lost. So obviously there are still challenges, but we're finally getting some good news, and it's really, like I say, broad-based across the state. While not every county is adding jobs yet, every broad region of the state is. And that includes southern areas of the state, which have been slow to recover so far in the recession, or rather the expansion as it's been. But even in southern Oregon, we're starting to see, yeah.
Excuse me to interrupt, Mark, but just I want to make sure that when I hear your presentation, I understand what you define as rural Oregon. So could we just make sure we know what your assumptions are as you present this information?
Yes, Representative McLean, thank you so much, Chair Clem, for slowing me down on that. Yes, we're loose with our definition of rural Oregon. Typically, it's everything outside of the metropolitan areas. But that said, sometimes I will talk about Bend and the surrounding areas as rural as well. But here, you'll see the way I've defined the regions that we're talking about here, and in the first chart. North Coast, Clatsop, Lincoln, Tillamook County. The Gorge is Gilliam, Hood River, Sherman, Wasco, and Wheeler. Northeast is Baker, Grant, Moro, Umatilla, Union, and Wallowa. The Southeast, Harney, Klamath, Lake, Mahler. South Coast, Coos and Curry. And that's how we have our regions are a little different than the workforce regions you'll see in the employment department, but these are a little bit more homogenous in terms of their economic infrastructure or the industries that they have in their industry mix. So Southern Oregon, both west and east, has been slower to improve, but we're starting to see stuff there, too, in terms of pockets of strength. Jackson County, very strong. More recently, Josephine County jumping along. The Treasure Valley is doing well. And in some of the most recent employment numbers, they're all good. Now, we take the recent ones with a grain of salt because they're revised a lot. But looking at some of that, we see some really encouraging stuff with Coos and Curry County, both with jobs growing at twice the national average over the last few months and things like that. So hopefully hopefully this is a good story. And we do have some drivers and sources of strength that you see across the way. We heard a little bit about Port of Morrow and Boardman today as already. But it's not just the pockets of strength that are helping rural areas. It's also the lifting of weights. We had during the first 2 or 3 years of our expansion, we were really seeing no growth whatsoever across rural Oregon, and a lot had to do with the nature of the recession in terms of hitting housing-related industries and government, particularly K-12 education, disproportionately hard. And as those weights started to lift and that drag started to pull off of that last year or so, we finally have been able to see some improvement in terms of the typical rural area. So typically when I talk about rural Oregon, and what I did last year was I really focus on demographics because it's the thing that stands out. It's one of these things is not like the other. When you look at any place in America that's taken the same kind of gut punch as rural Oregon in terms of losses of resource and manufacturing jobs, we're talking about places like Flint, Michigan, and Youngstown, Ohio, and the Rust Belt, or our farm towns that in the Midwest, or some of the textile mill towns in the South. All of these places not only lost their main employers and took huge chunk of a third of their jobs lost when the industries restructured, they lost people as a result. When the jobs were gone, people left, and the population in these areas shrank. And that's not what we're seeing here in Oregon, and that is one thing that's, you know, very, very encouraging, of course. For economists, it's a little bit more difficult to understand or to deal with in typical growth. Regional economists love when working age, young, skilled households move to your area, like what's happening in Portland. But this isn't, of course, what's happening in the rural areas. We're supporting population growth, but we are still losing a lot of our prime working age, younger households to the city. And they're being replaced a lot of times by retiree households with wealth rather than current income, which is a different character and a different challenge in terms of leveraging this both for public services and for local economic activity. And even the places that don't get the migrants from California, the southern areas, particularly the coastal areas and central Oregon that really get a whole lot of these wealthy California families, even some of our areas that are more remote and even more challenged economically are doing well in terms of demographics. But they're really the flip side of the rest of rural Oregon. And so far as some of our eastern counties are getting young working age households and losing their current residents to other states, Idaho and Washington and the like, while they're getting folks from abroad or from other states that recently migrated from abroad. And so we're getting international migrants that are replacing some of the domestic or current population in some of these rural areas. And so this is encouraging insofar as the aging population is really the disease that's going on out there. And so bringing in young working age households is the cure. But obviously there's some challenges in terms of workforce matching and getting the population skills for what's needed for the employers of next year.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Could we back up a little bit, and could you help me understand the retirement community that you characterize as a disease in our economy?
Representative Clem Gomberg, as you'll see, I am very excited about the baby boom population cohort, as my next few comments will show. But what I meant, in all seriousness, is that we are very concerned about both the potential growth in Oregon and the viability of our state resource instruments in light of the aging baby boom population cohort. And rather than a disease, they've been wonderful insofar as we're losing a lot of workers that are extremely productive right now. They have a lifetime of experience, and these aren't just regular workers. These are very, very good at their job workers. And as these drop off, it's going to be difficult in terms of our labor force dynamics to support the same kind of growth that we have in the past. But a disease is probably not the word I should have used.
And I gather, you know, as time passes, once that generation passes, we'd be in danger of actually population declines. Because if there's not the young families and the baby boom, the next generation of retirees is much smaller. You could end up with actual population declines.
Absolutely, Chair Clem, and it's also coordinated at the same time that this bulge of the millennials is starting to age out as well, and our urban areas gain so much of those younger households, and our rural areas gain so many of the younger retirees, that there is some discussion out there about the timing of this demographic slowdown and whether or not Oregon will lose its traditional advantage relative to other states. So, yeah, but this narrative has really been picked up now. From last year when we were talking about it, really no one was. Rural Oregon was, you know, this pit, but you know, there was nothing, no indicators that were good anywhere you looked. But now it's really been picked up out there, and the conventional wisdom now is that, well, a lot of rural Oregon gets a lot of old folks, and old folks must need health care, and they also get a lot of federal dollars to pay for this. So this is going to be, you know, good for rural Oregon. And while it's exciting that a lot of folks in Portland are now talking about rural Oregon, full disclosure, my family's from there, so I'm a little bit biased, but it's still a little misleading, because not all places are going to be able to benefit from this phenomenon. And it's set off a lot of alarm bells with some of the old-timer economists across the state. This isn't the first time people have been thinking about rural Oregon, and we have economists out there that talk about this. And in terms of this health care, federal dollars thing, the issue is most of the labor-intensive health care that goes on and the highest expenditure health care that goes on happens very late in life. Not in the early retirement years, but in later retirement years, when folks' health starts to fail. That's when they really start to incur these costs. And what old-time regional economists will tell you here is that not all these areas are going to keep the retirees when they enter this next phase of their life, even if they're gaining retirees now. One of our advisors, Hans Rodke of the Coast, he says that folks move out to the coast to retire, but then they move back to the cities to die. And so we do see a little bit of that. And for the timing of that, in response to Chair Clem's question, Bruce Sorte at the Oregon State University has been doing a lot of work over the years trying to measure the timing of this and the impact on different counties of the state as folks get into their advanced retirement years. And maybe we see this backing out of some of these great population gains that we've seen. So not only, I think, is this focus on taking care of old folks in their illnesses years is not just wrong, but it's a little insulting too, in a way, because I think we have more going for us, or rural Oregon does more than this, for lack of a better term, this hospice economy, right, where we wire money from D.C. to give sponge baths to the retirees from California. I'm more bullish than that. I think that we have a little bit more going for us in terms of the active economy and what in particular these young retirees bring actively to the region in terms of volunteerism and philanthropy. The numbers are really impressive in terms of that, and more so in terms of what they're doing in terms of businesses. So when you're a younger retiree, you're not ready to just golf and watch soap operas all day. You're doing stuff, and we see that in some places of the state. Well, in particular, the outlier would be Bend. Now, not all rural areas can be Bend or want to be Bend, but that's the only place in the state where there's more venture capital per job than the U.S. average. And there's a reason for that, because these retirees are coming up, and they're doing something, and they're using their money and leveraging it. And Bend has the same demographic issues as a lot of rural Oregon in terms of a relatively small population cohort in those 20s and 30s, the great root-setting years, but they don't worry about it because they can bring those folks in, because they'll provide, if they can build a nice, good job and they have the living, which obviously a lot of rural area does have the quality of life, they can bring folks in. And it looks like most of rural Oregon shares some of that with Bend. It's not just population growth that's keeps Oregon's rural areas apart, sets them apart from the rest of the really hard-hit manufacturing and resource hubs. It's also educational attainment and the quality of jobs. Here we're looking at shares of folks with college degrees across the state, and in terms of averages, they're just some of our northeast and south coasts are just a hair under the typical U.S. rural area, despite how hard they were hit. So that's impressive. With medians, we're even better. And you can say across the coast in terms of medians, we don't have any county that's below the national average. So that would suggest that, like Bend, if, you know, we can create the jobs, that folks will come. It, typically, there's, you know, it's a little encouraging. You know, you have the chicken and the egg problem. When there are no skilled young workers, that a lot of firms don't want to locate in your area. But at the same time, here it looks like I think we probably have less of that issue. Rather, it's the opposite, that we need to provide the jobs. And I think that some of the retirees will indeed do that and are doing that. Over the last 10 years, we've seen significantly more high-wage jobs in rural Oregon than in the typical rural metropolitan area. So that's encouraging. Then they're across different industries. There are some healthcare jobs in here, but there are also management jobs and encouragingly some of our traditional resource and manufacturing jobs. As we're getting more and more high value added, we're seeing more high-wage jobs. On a whole, we've obviously the manufacturing and resource jobs over time, their wages have eroded down to the average of everyone else. But now we're starting to see some of this more high-end occupations coming out as well, which certainly is encouraging. And so far as diversification is always going to be the key for these rural areas. And there is no single rural development strategy, because every place is certainly very, very different and very unique. But most of them do appear, you know, when you stand back and take into account what a horrible shock these areas went through, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, they're all on pretty good ground. But the one thing I guess they all do have in common would be a very strong dependence on housing. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and pass it along to Josh to talk a little bit about housing affordability.
Thanks, Mark. For the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. And housing affordability more broadly is an increasing concern. It's most acute, it's most pronounced in the state of Oregon today in, say, Portland and Bend, where they're having some housing shortages. But it's an issue we constantly hear whenever we go out across the state. Once a year, our office, along with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, visits a location in the state to get out and meet businesses and the local communities and tour some factories or what have you. And so they talk about workforce housing issues in Pendleton, where they're not able to have enough, you know, moderate priced homes to support the workers, so they have to live, whether it's in Hermiston or Baker City or whatever, and commute in. And you hear about it on the coast and other places talking about just the need for more housing or more flexible land use policies. And our office doesn't do policies, but this is a topic that comes up everywhere, even if it's most pressing today, say in Portland and Bend. And the biggest issues today in the housing market is it's all about supply and demand. And what you see in front of you is household formation. This is the number of new households being formed every year in Oregon's back up to 30,000 a year. We're getting about 35,000 individuals moving to Oregon every year, but we're creating about 30,000 households, and a lot of that has to do with demographics, and the millennials are exiting their college years and setting foot on their own. And so we're seeing a tremendous increase in the need for more housing, yet the supply response or the new construction to meet up with this population growth and this household formation is incomplete. If we go to the next slide, you can see here across the state, doesn't matter which county you pick at, outside of Multnomah County, every other county is building less new apartments, new homes today than they were a decade ago. And sure, a decade ago we were in the midst of a housing bubble. In a lot of regions of the state, though, the housing bubble wasn't so much about overbuilding physical homes. It had to do with the price mentality and just, I need to buy at whatever price I can get it. Doesn't matter. I can refinance a year or two later and I'll still make money on the deal. That's the bubble mentality. That's not back in place today as far as we can tell based on survey results of how people are viewing housing and their long-term goals and things like that. However, you can see here in Salem, Medford, Eugene, in the rural areas, we're building less homes today even though the population growth has picked back up. And the issue is most pressing on the rental side. And if we go to the next slide, this is a really complicated graph for a simple point that renters are being squeezed much more so than homeowners. Homeowners, almost by definition, have more money. You have to put down 5, 10, hopefully 20% for a down payment. You're going to earn a larger income, have a higher salary, all that sort of stuff. And so you're able to finance it, particularly with these low interest rates we're seeing today. Renters, less so. We've had three different factors going on today that's pushed more people into the renter's market. We have the bulk of the millennials are in their 20s today, and so that's more renters just due to lifestyle choices. And then we also have going on are taste and preferences. Some people are preferring the urban living or the apartment living relative to single-family suburban life. And then also importantly are the foreclosures and the housing cycle itself. A lot of people were forced out of their homes. And then also your housing credit availability is less today. The lending standards have not loosened, which overall is a good thing for the health of the financial sector. But at the same time, it's forcing more people to be renters, even if they'd want to be homeowners because they can't get the credit. And so we have all these three different things happening at the same time, pushing more people into the renter's market. And what this graph shows you is individual zip codes here in Oregon, all the different zip codes in Oregon. On the vertical axis is the percentage of their housing that they spend out of their income in every month. And the common definition of being rent burden is 30%, right? If you're spending 30% or more of your income on housing, you have a problem. Because it's a ratio, you know, there's a denominator, numerator issue that can cause some problems there. And so 30% is a rough measure. It's a fine rough measure, but it's incomplete. And so what we've also done here is another approach to housing affordability is called residual income. It's basically how much money do you have left over after you pay for housing? So it's non-shelter expenditures, and it shows about $25,000 is what the typical household in the U.S. spends outside of shelter. If you're sort of not in the bottom 20% of the income spectrum, but in that second quintile, so between 20th and 40th percent, so you're not in poverty in and of itself, but you're a little above the poverty level. So it's just a rough measure to kind of show that the 30% is an incomplete measure. But at the same time, 70% of individual zip codes in Oregon are facing residual income issues in the sense that they don't have $25,000 left over to spend on food and health care and clothing for their kids to get to school and things like that. And just highlighted the zip codes here in Salem and around Salem real quickly. And even within an area like Salem, we have vast differences between West Salem and downtown Salem. Just due to the characterizations of the neighborhoods and the jobs that are provided and things like that. And so the biggest thing here is on the 30% side, a lot of that has to do with increasing rents and pressures for due to the supply and demand. However, on the horizontal axis, the residual income, a lot of that has to do with the number of jobs and the quality of the jobs and the wages that they pay in terms of how households are feeling constrained by housing costs and their overall household budget situation. Quickly moving on to the Portland challenge is a little bit different in that it's an overall supply constraint. It's not just the rental versus the ownership, but if you look at all the 50 largest metropolitan areas in the country, the ones that build a lot have lower prices, and the ones that don't build very much have high prices. And some of that has to do with different constraints, whether they're land use policies or whether there's geographic constraints. City of San Francisco or the metropolitan area can't really build that much. They're surrounded by water, so they have some geographic constraints around that and things like that. The other component here is demand and population growth. All the ones on the at the top of the vertical axis, throw in New York and Boston that are in there as well, they're seeing population growth. But down in the lower left-hand corner, you have your Rust Belts, your Detroits and your Pittsburghs and your places of the country like that, your Clevelands. They don't have a housing affordability issue today, but they're also not facing population growth like we are. And so I think it's interesting. Right there in the middle of the curve, you see Seattle, Denver, and Portland. These are thriving, trendy, hip metropolitan areas of which a lot of people want to move to. So it seems like that these places have been able to build just enough homes to keep housing affordability at a somewhat manageable level. We're able to keep our heads above water just enough to keep some semblance of affordability and not slide into the California or the New York housing price range. And then lastly, this is something our office, we're just starting to look into this, is are we at peak renter today? Because again, we had the confluence of those different things where we had the foreclosure crisis and the credit availability standards, which should loosen over time. So housing credit should open back up to more people, particularly as the economy rebounds. But then the demographics are a really big component here because the millennials, the typical millennials, 23, 24 years old today. If you look at every generation prior to the millennials, by the time you're 40, you own a home. Most people own a home. And so as you age the millennials through their 30s and into their 40s, that's what you get this light blue line here where it shows we're starting to see increase in home ownership again. And of course, the baby boomers, as they get into their later lives, as Mark was talking about, they turn back into renters and they live in retirement facilities and things like that. And so we have these different components here that are influenced, but the demographics suggest that we will shift away or the trends will be back away from the rental market and back towards the ownership market. And the one thing this doesn't account for are taste, right? To what degree have we made a permanent shift in this country to say we want to live in a high rise at the urban core? Again, some of that, there's a taste shift going on there, but I think a lot of it is the demographics, again, with the millennials being in their 20 years today. And with that, that's all we had for prepared remarks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Vice Chair Post. Yeah. I'll just spend some time on that.
I'm sorry. Josh. Yes. Could you go back to that slide? Because it's I find it fascinating. Because from my own personal experience, I have a 23-year-old son, and he and all of his friends in that, all his buddies are 20 to 29, right in that area. You know, when I was 20, I couldn't wait to own my first house because that was driven into me by my parents and by my grandparents. He has zero desire. Own a house? Why would I ever want to do that? So what you touched on, it's interesting. I'm wondering how much, and I know you can't address the emotional state of America today and Oregon and the young people of today, but it was just fascinating. I don't know if he is representative of his age group or not, but they have zero desire. They would really love to just rent. Whereas I was like, that's a horrible thing. Why would I ever want to give my money to somebody else? You know what I mean? So how can you put that into play with the actual crunching of numbers? Or can you? Maybe I'm being vague.
Chair Clem, Representative Post, you're absolutely right. And that's something that we have a hard time with. You see these surveys out there, preferences and things like that. But again, your 23-year-old son, he's representative of 23-year-olds today. There's no question. But what is he going to be like when he's 35? And that's the hard thing to project. Mm-hmm. What are their tastes going to be like? How much? So I think there probably is some sort of permanent shift there in the taste. But is it 100%? Are we never going to go back to the ownership market? That's a hard thing to say, again, because we've never seen it. And then one more thing I would add to that is one of the discussions is there's a lot of transactions costs with owning a home or buying and selling a home, right? You have to pay the closing costs and you have to pay the realtor fees and all that sort of stuff. So to the extent that we're seeing more turnover in the job market, where you might lose your job after a short duration, have to pick up and move to another city sort of thing, whether it's a San Francisco or what have you for the tech sector, it doesn't make sense to own a home because you have to pay those large fees. So home ownership only makes sense if you're confident in your situation where you think you have, A, enough income, and, B, it's sustainable enough or durable enough that you're not going to have to worry about trying to sell your home on short notice.
Yeah, and just to add, Representative Post, one of the confusions is tastes change a lot between when you're 23 and 33, typically when you have a couple of kids. So maybe check back after you have a couple of grandkids, then the suburbs start to look a little more attractive sometimes when you have a couple little ones with you. And so that's an open question, whether the millennials will become like our generation more as they age and get into their child-rearing years.
And let me come down here. I will say one thing. One of the reasons I asked for them to touch on housing as well is you might recall, you might not. There is a mini debate that we heard a little bit in this committee. It's a big debate, but we heard a little bit in this committee about something Mr. Chandler brought up about the numbers. And their industry relies on projections. And if the projections indicate nobody wants single-family homes anymore, they have a problem. So they want to make sure when those projections saying people don't want single family homes anymore that they're actually true and right and durable and going to last, because our policies in this state are based on those projections. And so particularly in the metro Portland area, the projections have said most people don't want to live in those kind of homes. Well, that makes home builders pretty nervous. So that's part of why I wanted to get into this, because part of why I wanted this topic brought up is we do have policies that control supply to a large degree based on these sort of guesses. And what I've heard from Metro, and we'll get into this with them at another point, I think, is they think people are changing because people aren't making as much money, so therefore they don't want to have a car. They are maybe more mobile. The things have changed, and we're becoming more like some other countries, you know, where if people don't have as much money, they're having to do more sharing. They're having to live in different kind of places. They use Uber instead of having their own car, all that kind of stuff. So therefore, that's where people want to be. and I think Mr. Chandler's point is, if you build it and they have low-cost, affordable, suburban, cul-de-sac-style homes, you know, then maybe that's not true. And it's an open debate. But that's part of why I wanted you to talk about this, not just rural Oregon, because you know, this committee should be at least talking about supply and infrastructure, because we just, through this committee last short session, expanded the UGB in Portland metro area pretty massively through the grand bargain, but a lot of those areas can't be built yet because they're still trying to figure out how to finance the infrastructure to build all this new UGB area we just got. So it's not only supply exclusively by any means, but it is something that between mortgage availability, supply, infrastructure for building new either single family or residential, it is creating a real problem that is, I'm sure, brought to all of our attentions in areas where renters are starting to really feel this pinch. At least I'm hearing about it, even in Salem, which I know Portland and Bend have no vacancy rates. And Salem is, I didn't think that quite that bad. So I'll just work down the list here. Representative McLean, then Gomberg.
Thank you. I suppose it's a lot like projecting sales of minivans. If you ask males in their 20s if they can imagine themselves driving minivans, they would decline and offer a derogatory response. And yet, when I was in my 30s, I bought a minivan and drove it proudly to T-ball games and the like. So I can imagine there is some reliability of projecting forward as millennials, which is a big generation, grows, that there'll be demand increase. One thing about that, does your numbers presuppose a static UGB growth? Obviously, the area which is in most demand in our state, and certainly in Bend, this is reality, you know, there is a supply, failure of the supply. Bottom line is there's not enough land supply because of our policy as opposed to what is actually there. And so do these numbers presuppose a static supply?
Yes, we do not make allowances for differences in that. We just say whatever, you know, we assume that there will be enough supply given what we have today, and we don't whittle it down. We don't. That's why it says it's a demographic based projection, right? We're not trying to account for the taste component of it, and taste might be a little misleading in the sense that sometimes you only get to, you know, if you want to choose between a single family home in the suburbs and multifamily in the urban core, well, if that single family in the suburbs doesn't exist, then you have to choose the multifamily, right? So I think, so the taste there, it also talks about the available supply at the same time. If we're only going to be providing more multifamily, by definition, people will choose multifamily because they have no alternatives. So this, again, just looks at the demographics themselves. It fixes everything else. So the increase in the rentership rates that we've seen in the last decade, we fix that. And we say today, moving forward, we're going to keep the same renterships by age. But then what does just the aging of the population alone do to this? And that's what this gets at. And it suggests that the demographics suggest that we're kind of near or at peak renter. But those other things that you brought up about supply versus a general taste about what the kids these days want, those are the unknown things. And we'll shift that line around accordingly.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, gentlemen. Interesting stuff. Mr. McMullins, we started out today talking about our senior population as a disease and moved into discussing the hospice industry. And then you started to save yourself by talking about the money that this particular community brings to the rural areas. And you also talked about volunteerism and the wonderful contributions that our older populations provide in our local communities, particularly when younger families may not have as much time as they historically had. I want to give you a chance to save yourself a little bit more. In my home county, Lincoln County, the population over the age of 65 is 22% of the total, compared to 14% statewide. And we've got recent studies now indicating that transfer payments bring more money into our communities than dairy or fishing or tourism. Those other communities may employ more people as we measure, but more money is coming in through pensions and SSI and other types of transfer payments. And what I think is particularly interesting about that is that this is money that is invested not only in healthcare, but we have a population that has 20 productive years, and they are investing in recreation. They're investing in real estate. They're investing in hospitality, using our restaurants, and they're investing year-round rather than just our high seasons. And I wanted to give you a chance to talk about that in a little more depth, because I regard our retirement community as part of our economic cure. But specifically, I wanted to ask, if you can measure our success in dairy or tourism or in fishing, do we have similar tools to measure the investments that our retiring community is putting into rural areas in that broad variety of areas, whether it's healthcare, recreation, hospitality, or even simple maintenance, cleaning your gutters and cutting your lawns? Do we have the tools to measure the impact of the retirement industry?
Chair Clem, Representative Gomberg, the simple answer to whether or not we have those tools is not really. But we know they're big. A lot of the rural areas that have a lack or are struggling to provide public services, these volunteerism is wonderful in the schools and the philanthropy, and we see it everywhere. And like I say, also in terms of retirees' investment in their own labor and their own little small businesses that they're building or their art studio or whatnot, we're really seeing, you know, a tremendous amount of contributions, but not all of them measurable. As economists, we know a lot about this income, like transfer payment is something we measure, and it's something that we tax, and we have good records of these income, but we don't have as good a record of people's wealth. But you know, their housing wealth and their stock assets and things like that, and how those interact with the economy. And the same to be said for volunteerism and philanthropy. We get, you know, nationwide studies, but you know, no real good hard data to work at. But in terms of the income data, where you see that transfer payments are greater than all these industries that you know are really the lifeblood of a lot of coastal economies, that's a little overstated. In particular, since we're not just talking about the direct income that the fishing boats bring in, right? There are supply chains, and there are downstream impacts of your different industries, and to the extent to which those are local and the gains from those industries are realized locally, which is certainly true for a lot of the tourism and resource industries, that a lot of those gains are incurred locally. So the overall income impact is far more than your transfer payment, where the hospital CEO and the drug company are going to pull a lot of that. You know, a lot of that money is going to be profits for them and not necessarily generate local economic activity. Obviously, some of it does. You need doctors, hospitals, and whatnot. But a lot of it also bleeds outside of the region, whereas the traditional local industries that you mentioned also have very localized supply chains in a lot of cases, and so you get a bigger overall economic impact than that initial income would suggest.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And respectfully, I would say that we have the same kind of expanded economy within the retirement industry that we do with the supply chains that we have for fishing or tourism or dairy. It's just a little more difficult to discern those supply chains when it's a kid cutting your lawn, or whether it's money being spent in a restaurant, and that restaurant is then getting a supply chain of food and service and maintenance as well. So I think it's out there. I recognize that it's hard to measure, but if there is a paradigm shift going on and we're getting more and more retirement to rural Oregon, I think it's going to become increasingly important that we find a way to accurately measure that so we can figure out what's going on and how to better address it.
It seems to me like one of the, you know, you talked about diversity, and one of the prescriptions is, you know, having the ability for young people to stay and make a better living, getting educational attainment up, either through continuing support community colleges and more ways to access through distance learning, higher ed degrees, so you don't have to travel all the way in, you can keep the low housing costs.
But you also have to figure out a way to have sustainable utilization of the natural resources that once were a backbone of younger people's jobs. You know, I grew up in Coos Bay, coming right out of the mills, didn't need to go to college, could make good money. And not just because of the spotted owl, the industry also changed somewhat on automation and, you know, cutting for the metric system instead of, you know, domestic. And so a lot of things happened. But having the ability to bring back some of these things, like we're doing this cross-laminated forestry and some interesting products that could bring back, it seems like you do all of it at the same time, and access to broadband and, you know, and getting some of these. I noticed in Southern Oregon in particular, a lot of the mentors to younger entrepreneurs are retired executives from, like at So Ready, their economic development, mm-hmm. Jim Fox, some of these guys are retired Silicon Valley execs who live in Medford, and they coach and they bring their cash. Let's get young people in startups. And if we help facilitate those kind of relationships, if they're not happening on their own, I think you have a decent shot. I have one brother who works in Coos Bay, went to college. One works at Microsoft in Bellevue. The other was able to go back once broadband came, and he works for Husky, which is like a global plastics injection molding, doing global IT support from his slippers out in the garage. And then he just flies to wherever he needs to go around the world to support their IT needs, but mostly he can just do it through the internet. But you know, they had to get broadband first, and he had to decide he wanted to go back. And so I think it's possible to find solutions, but you know, part of it means rethinking some of our policies as well, both state and federally in particular. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to follow up on a point that I think Representative McLean was making. And are you aware of any graphs that might be available that would show the percentage of housing costs that would be attributable to land use decisions for, say, the largest 100 cities in the United States?
Chair Klim, Representative Witt, not offhand. There have been a few studies in recent years that have introduced variables into the models about land use. And I tried to track one down the other day, and I couldn't find it, so I have to go in and I'll try and find something to forward it. There is something, it depends upon how you define that. There is something from the Brookings Institution where they look at the 100 largest metropolitan areas, and then they kind of just rank them. They look at some data, and then they kind of rank them 1 to 100. And what stuck out to me is Portland ranked 71st most restrictive out of the 100, which was surprising, you would think, given the UGB. So it has more to do with, once you say you can develop that land, what can you do with it? It's not the aggregate big picture restriction of a UGB. And so within Portland, you have pretty flexible, right? Do you want to put a storefront commercial or multifamily or single family, right? You have a lot of flexibility once you can get a hold of the land. So I think that measure obviously is not the one that I think a lot of people in this panel we were talking about this morning. So, but there's been another study that I'll try and track it down and forward it to the committee.
I think both of those studies would be interesting.
Yeah, Beth and I were talking about Salem. You can't do some of the things in Salem you can do in Portland. You can't put a renter in your home the same way you can. We're not set up for mixed use the way they are. And so it does create some interesting situations. And there's huge parts of the metro area, like North Bethany, that have been brought in long ago. They still aren't developed. And so I think UGB questions and the things we've done to try and streamline, making sure that actually works for places like Woodburn and Bend, who've been trying for 17 years to expand theirs. You know, I think there's a variety of issues. And I know, you know, I'm looking for Mr. Chandler, there's a list apparently that he and 1,000 friends came up with of like 20 things they both agree could be done to help build things. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Let's get that list, and let's start pounding away on that list as well.
Thank you.
Representative Doctor.
Thank you. Early in your presentation, we talked about job recovery and that we're making up a lot of the jobs that we lost previously, and I wanted to ask whether we're making up the dollars that we lost previously. And there's a perception that we're replacing high-paying old jobs with low-paying new jobs, but I think that you were quoted in at least one report recently saying that's not necessarily the case.
Yes, Representative Gomberg. We are gaining high-wage jobs and low-wage jobs, but not a whole lot in the middle. in terms of the spectrum. And this is true everywhere, rural, urban, across the U.S. This is a phenomenon that's happening in terms of this erosion of the mid-wage jobs. They get hit hardest in the recessions and don't seem to come back in the recoveries. And that's certainly true in terms of jobs in rural Oregon. Now, overall, in terms of the wages we're getting, we are, on average, we are seeing healthy wage growth in Oregon, and that is different than the rest of the U.S. That's one thing that the Fed chairwoman and monetary policymakers are waiting to see at the U.S. before they start raising rates, is that these low unemployment rates, when are they going to start showing up as more dollars in the pockets of workers, and then they're worried about inflation for following that. Well, for us in Oregon, it's been a good almost 2 years now where we've had as strong wage gains as we had during the housing boom. So we're seeing it here, and a lot of it's in rural Oregon as well. So that's encouraging that we are starting to see some of that improvement. So yeah, we are getting a little bit more pay. There's still an issue in terms of our traditional middle wage occupations and that being hollowed out, but there has been some improvement. Now, even with the job growth in our metropolitan areas, and we are back to what we had before the recession, and even there's an issue in terms of population growth where, yeah, we're back to where we were before the recession, but we have a lot more people here now. And so we're still a year, year and a half away from being in the same sort of relative position, even in, you know, the state as a whole, to where we were before the bottom dropped out.
Thank you. Brian?
Representative McClain, then to Vice Chair Post.
Just on that, Mark, on that slide, are those private sector jobs?
These are both private sector and public sector jobs. In the middle wage, you get a lot of the manufacturing, construction workers, and K through 12 teachers. Those would also be in the middle wage.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you. I want to go back to the first slide that led to the slide you just now had up. I'm sorry, not the first slide.
Sorry.
A couple more. The one just before
sorry.
That showed the different areas.
Oh, sure.
That you there.
There.
And we talked about, the question was asked about what is urban rural, and you gave a great answer. What I was sitting here as one who lives in a very rural area that's in the middle of urban areas. So what I don't see represented there is what I would call, and I just made a little diagram for myself, you know, Portland, rural, Eugene, rural, Medford. I don't see that in any of these graphs. How are we measuring? You know, my district is St. Paul, mm-hmm. Newburgh, Kaiser, and then below me, Representative Gilliam's out in Silverton and Mount Angel. How are we measuring?
Not below you.
Not below you.
Might be south.
And Scotts Mills.
The east.
But I don't see that anywhere on there. Have you guys been measuring that at all, or do you consider that a separate, or is that just you're calling that urban?
Your Representative Post, it's dated limitations. Our best data is at the county level. So we don't count Lane County as rural, but if you lived out in Florence, you'd probably think it was, right? You know, so unfortunately, we're using the county boundaries here just because that's where we have the most detailed, timely data. To break it down, to the zip code or the city level is challenging. So being lazy, this is at the county high level.
Well, this has been great, and I at least really appreciate your. I think I read an op-ed that Josh had written or somebody in the Oregonian, and that's what got me interested. And you know, at least for me personally, I'm trying to get away from dogmatic, party-based or ideological-based positions on things, and just trying to get the truth about these things and sort out. And the answers are probably a lot more complicated. And how you address things like housing supply, it's probably a whole bunch of different things. You know, it's not just build a bunch more houses or, you know, release mortgage lending back down to, you can just walk in and get a mortgage tomorrow if you want to. It's probably a whole package of things, including infrastructure and annexation policy and all this stuff. But I appreciate that you both have very independent views that don't have to take into consideration all of the political stuff we often hear about and have to think about. And you know, I think we'd like to be able to keep using you as a resource for these kinds of things.
Well, thanks. Glad we could be of help.
Great. So why don't we get into our Federal Clean Water Act, Waters of the United States rule. Knowing him, I'm sure Director Whitman has a lot of opinions on all these. Oh, former Director Whitman, now Natural Resource Advisor, has lots of opinions on all these other topics, but you're welcome to chime in or not. And for just a little briefing for the committee, none of you probably have heard about that in this committee because we haven't talked about it in this committee, but I was looking at water-related things since we avoided talking about water almost all session because the Senate had all the action and we didn't have that many bills total. So a drought update and a particular issue about federal water. Well, I'll let them explain it, but I asked them to come because I was looking for some water related topics for us, and while this is mostly a federal rule, I did want to have you hear about it because it's a big deal, particularly in rural areas.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kate Brown's Natural Resource Advisor. I've got with me Paul Garahan, who's the attorney in charge of the Natural Resource Section in Oregon Department of Justice, and Lori Bensel, who's the Senior Assistant Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice. And I'm going to decline your invitation, at least for today, to talk about land use. But to the extent there are members of the committee who are interested in land use issues as they relate to housing cost, I would be happy to follow up with folks individually. There is research that's been done on that issue. Again, I'm not going to get into it today, but it is, I know, a question that is on many people's minds because of the escalation we've seen in housing costs recently. So with that, I'm going to turn to something that is actually a much drier, no pun intended, subject. The Waters of the State rule adopted by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and EPA. This is an issue that, frankly, has been politicized nationally. And a lot of what I'm going to do today is walk you through fairly carefully why it is our view that the rule adopted by the Corps and EPA actually does not represent a significant change in policy or practice by the federal government in terms of the extent of what the federal government regulates under the Clean Water Act. So bear with me. There's going to be a fair amount of legalism in this presentation.
Richard, one thing, if you're going to cover it, let me know. Mm-hmm. One thing I didn't say is there was a rule issued recently. There are some states who are suing the rule. Other states are not suing the rule. And I was interested in hearing about Oregon's view on it. That's the other reason I asked them to come.
Right. So there is, and Mr. Garahan, I think, will go into a little bit of the litigation, but there are multiple lawsuits in multiple district courts and circuit courts across the country. The state of Oregon, along with a number of other states, including the state of Washington, have intervened in defense of the rule adopted by the federal government. But again, Mr. Garahan is going to cover that aspect of where we're at. What I want to do is really run you through a little bit of historical perspective on this in terms of how this issue has developed over time and how it compares to the rule that was just adopted. So again, that's going to be sort of legalistic. Obviously, I'm not representing the state of Oregon as an attorney anymore. So the legal views expressed in this presentation are my own. They're not necessarily those of the Oregon Department of Justice or the state. So just a quick primer, first of all. The Federal Clean Water Act has two main permitting sections. Section 402, which is the section that requires permits for the discharge of pollutants into waters of the U.S. That's the federal water quality permit program, if you will. And then Section 404, which is more commonly known as the wetlands permit program, although it's actually for the discharge of dredge material into any waters of the U.S., including wetlands, but also including streams or the ocean, for that matter. So this definition, this issue of what are waters of the U.S., has a direct effect on how far the federal government goes in terms of when it requires a permit under either of those programs. Congress, when it adopted the Clean Water Act, was not very helpful on this point because it simply said that permits are required for discharges to waters of the U.S. and left it really to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the EPA to decide by rule, and the courts in court decisions when a permit would or would not be required. So let me begin the history with there are three major U.S. Supreme Court cases on this issue of what are waters of the U.S. They span 21 years, starting in 1985 with Riverside Bayview Homes. In that case, the Corps and EPA required a permit for fill on 80 acres of wetlands adjacent to a creek and near a lake, even though the wetlands were wet because of groundwater rather than direct connection to the creek. At that point, the EPA focused that decision and its rules were focused on the interplay between waters and functions of those waters, the ecological function of those waters. And that was based on the whole premise that the Clean Water Act is all about getting to clean water in the United States and water quality. The court didn't have any problem upholding the core decision in that case. It was a unanimous decision upholding jurisdiction. Then 16 years later, in a case called Swank, the Corps and EPA had required a permit for isolated ponds and mud flats that were not connected really in any way to other waters, so totally isolated. The Corps and EPA asserted jurisdiction on the basis that migratory birds landed on these mud flats and went to these wetlands. And the Corps asserted that it had jurisdiction because under a part of the federal constitution, the Commerce Clause, the health and well-being of those birds, if you will, could be affected by the wetlands and water. So that was sort of the most expansive interpretation of how far the Corps and EPA could go. And the court struck it down in a 5-4 decision in 2001 and basically said, no, you can't base your jurisdiction on the Commerce Clause. Congress, when it enacted the Clean Water Act, said you need a permit for a discharge to navigable waters, and we're going to read that as a limitation on how far you could otherwise go under the Commerce Clause. There has to be some more direct tie to really the purposes of the Clean Water Act in terms of water quality of navigable waters, and held that in that case, because the waters were totally isolated, that there really wasn't much of a water quality issue there. Then we get to the most recent case in 2006 where there was no majority opinion. And this is where things really get messed up, frankly. And they get messed up because of the lack of congressional direction, the core EPA effort to take a very broad approach to what jurisdiction they have, and then the court's inability to get to any sort of real consensus on what the right answer is here. So the court decision in Rapinos in 2006 results in three different tests, conflicting tests for when the Corps and EPA have jurisdiction. And the other thing to note in that opinion is that several of the justices on the Supreme Court essentially begged EPA and the Corps to go back and undertake a rulemaking and sort this all out in a rulemaking. Before I get to the rulemaking, let me talk about the three different tests. First of all, there's the plurality opinion test, which is the test that was advocated by four justices who were on the winning side, if you will, of the vote. Then you had four justices in a dissent. I'll talk about that in a minute. And you had one justice, Justice Stevens, who was the swing vote, if you will. He joined in the result in terms of overturning the need for a permit in that particular case, but he did not join in the test that was advocated by the four justices on the winning side. So again, you've got a test advocated by one set of four justices, a test advocated by another four, and then somebody in the middle, Justice Stevens, who had his own test. So the plurality test required a couple of things. First of all, that there be water flowing relatively permanently in the water body. Not including ordinarily dry channels that have occasional or intermittent flows. And the second important thing was they required a continuous surface connection between the water body and other navigable waters. One important thing to note here is that opinion, even though it's thought of as the most conservative of the three tests, actually would require a permit in some cases, even though there's no significant effect on water quality. So as long as there's any connection of surface water, a permit would be required, even if that connection doesn't result in a significant effect on water quality. The second test is, I'm sorry, I said Justice Stevens, my bad, it was Justice Kennedy in the concurring opinion. And his test is very similar to the original test that was adopted by the first of these decisions, Riverside Bayview, basically saying that wetlands and other waters adjacent to navigable waterways are jurisdictional if they have a significant nexus to those navigable waters. What does significant nexus mean? It essentially means there's at least a potential significant effect on water quality. That's essentially what it comes down to. And then finally, we have the dissent's opinion, and the dissent's opinion goes a step further by essentially saying that all waterways adjacent to navigable waters require a permit. Even there's no case, no reason for, or no need for a case by case showing of a significant effect on water quality. So those are the three tests, and the Supreme Court precedent on which of those tests you need to follow in a situation like this isn't at all clear. So you have complete confusion in the lower courts about which of these three tests is the right test. Most of the confusion after 2006 was regarding wetlands and ditches. There was pretty good agreement in terms of tributaries in what are called traditionally navigable waters, which are tidal waters. All tidal waters are considered navigable. And then waters that have actually been determined navigable for essentially ownership purposes. Those always require a wetland permit or a 402 permit. And then interstate waters, waters that go over state lines, always require a permit. So in 2014, the Corps and EPA decided to take up the challenge put out by the Supreme Court and actually undertake a rulemaking. But before I get to describing what came out of that rulemaking, I want to talk just a little bit more about how, as a practical matter, the Corps and EPA were or were not requiring permits after the Rapinos decision in 2006. So first of all, talking about tributaries a little bit and seasonality. Basically, the guidance and the practice of the Corps and EPA was that if a stream flows at least two or three months out of the year on a regular basis, except in drought years, it was considered waters of the U.S. or navigable. So in Oregon, we call those intermittent streams, and I think most people know those waters as intermittent streams, and they're distinguished from what we call ephemeral streams, which are streams that really only flow when there's an unusual rain event. So in eastern Oregon, central Oregon, where we have less rain, you know, those would be your gullies and washes and swales that don't flow regularly on an annual basis, but flow when you've got a big storm, essentially. And those are not included and were not included in the definition of wetlands under CORE and EPA guidance. And then finally, I noted there was some controversy about ditches and canals, and it appears that prior to this new rule, those were essentially treated the same as tributaries. So if you have a ditch along a road and it has water in it more than 2 or 3 months out of the year, it would be normally considered a wetland or a water of the U.S. that would require a fill permit if you were going to fill above the minimum amounts in that ditch. Finally, a little more on the guidance. Adjacent wetlands were generally covered. As I said, ephemeral waters were not generally included. Isolated wetlands and other intrastate waters were not included. Swales, erosional features, generally not included. So that was the state of play before we had this new rule. So let me talk about the new rule just briefly. First of all, as I said at the outset, this really has gotten political. There were over a million comments submitted to EPA and the Corps. There was a lot of opinion out there that these rules represent a significant grab by the federal government for extending federal jurisdiction. And that led to most of those comments. Other thing to say about the rulemaking, there was extensive scientific work that went into the rulemaking as the basis for the rulemaking. There were science panels convened by not just EPA and CORE folks, but by other agencies and independent agencies in terms of the scientific basis for this rulemaking. And then just generally, what did the Corps and EPA do? Well, they kept most of the existing exclusions. And this is important to our agricultural community in particular. There are a number of exemptions in federal wetlands permitting that were continued in the new rule that exclude many, if not most, agricultural activities from having to obtain a federal permit. And then secondly, it sets up three categories of situations. First is a category where essentially automatically a permit will be required in almost all situations or all situations. There's a middle category, which is case-by-case determination. And then a third category where a permit just is not required. So what the rulemaking essentially did was it kept most of the exclusions. It expanded. It took some of those case-by-case determinations and moved a group of them into the category where a permit's automatically required. And then it moved another set of those case-by-case determinations and moved them into the exclusion. So it shrank the middle and expanded the two categories on the ends. And so administratively, that gets to the whole purpose of this rulemaking was not to run property owners and developers through the ringer of having to go through a case-by-case determination to figure out if a permit's required, but to create some clearer lines of when a permit is required and when a permit is definitely not required, and to shrink the number of situations where you have to go through that case-by-case determination. Overall, the agencies estimate, and I think OMB also estimated, that compared to prior practice, this would increase the extent of federal jurisdiction by about 3 to 5%. As compared to the prior rules, I talked about the migratory bird rule. That rule was still in place prior to this rulemaking. So it's formally gotten rid of the migratory bird rule, and now we don't need to have arguments about whether if birds land on a water body, you need to get a federal permit. Okay, briefly on a little more on the rule changes. So first of all, tributaries. This formalizes the prior practice that ephemeral tributaries generally do not require a permit. Tributaries with intermittent flow, so regularly 2 to 3 months at least a year, they do get some flow. Those do require permits. Before Yeah, okay. Let's see. Adjacent waters. So a lot of this is wetlands, but ponds or other waters adjacent to a navigable waterway. Before, you often had to show that it was going to have that water body was going to have a significant effect on water quality. Now, in all cases, those are going to require a permit. It's a practical matter. This really doesn't change things because when the agencies looked on a case-by-case basis before, and this is true of the tributaries before, they looked at all the tributaries in the watershed together in determining whether there would be a significant effect. Same thing for adjacent ponds or wetlands. They looked at all the wetlands adjacent to a particular water body in determining whether there'd be a significant effect on water quality. So these new per se rules really, in our view, do not change things other than to make the lines clearer. Final thing is just adjacent areas now clearly include riparian areas and floodplains. Again, as a practical matter, the Corps and EPA were requiring permits in those cases previously. Now they've simply formalized those practices. The final thing I want to just touch on, which is an area of that's a little where we do have some questions about how the Corps will implement this, is they've adopted a provision that says when you have a ephemeral tributary or a wetland that is not adjacent, but it's a little, it's starting to get a little further away, if it's within 4,000 feet of a navigable waterway, they're now going to require a case-by-case determination. We're not sure how that's going to play out. That is an area where I think we're going to have to watch to see how it plays out. It's an area of some concern, but that's really the only area in the new rule where we think there could be some issues. Finally, I just want to mention a couple of other things that the rule clearly does. It clearly excludes groundwater. There's been a lot of chatter out there that somehow the feds are reaching out to grab the state's water, including groundwater. That is not the case. The state continues to own water in the state. It continues to have the primacy to require permits for the use of water in the state. This rule doesn't change any of that. Again, this rule added an express exemption for gullies and swales. That was the practice before, but now it's clearly in the rule. And then finally, for ditches with ephemeral flows, again, that's flows that are really triggered by an unusual rainfall event and that don't typically happen, those are now clearly excluded. And we believe, actually, that's a helpful exclusion in the rule. So, you know, again, speaking to how this has gotten politicized, I won't comment on why it's gotten politicized, but again, it's a practical and policy matter. We do not agree that this new federal rule is a significant expansion of federal jurisdiction. It is a clarification, and frankly, a clarification that helps also clarify that federal jurisdiction is very, very similar to what the state regulates under our removal fill program. And this is the last point I want to make. Oregon has tried off and on for almost 20 years now to take over administration of the federal program in Oregon so that we don't have people having to run to the Corps and EPA for permitting. We still have statutes that that the Legislative Assembly passed encouraging the state to take on that task so that we can streamline and we can get people through the permitting process faster. We still, as a policy matter, want to accomplish that. And having this federal rule with the clear lines, we believe, will make it easier to get to that ultimate objective of both protecting the environment and improving water quality, but also relieving regulatory burden for landowners and developers. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
To go back one slide, I had a question.
The wrong person is operating the
previous. Yeah, this one. I think this is what the president of Metro was alluding to me. We were at a dinner, and he said he was a little bit worried about this, if I remember right, that it's something FEMA-related, and could you still develop in all these downtowns that happen to be near rivers if this really got interpreted in to its max worst possible extent?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, that's an excellent question. It actually has to do with something that's totally separate from what I just talked about, which is our national, federal, FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Authority flood insurance program. This is a big issue also. It's actually, in some ways, probably more serious and more problematic than what I just got through talking about. But FEMA has been going through a consultation with the two federal fisheries agencies, and they are about to issue a biological opinion and reasonable and prudent alternatives that are conditions on the operation of the flood insurance program. And just quickly, if you're a homeowner or any type of builder or property owner and you own property in the 100-year floodplain, you basically have to get, in order to get a loan from a bank, you have to get flood insurance. And so if there are conditions put on the flood insurance program by the fisheries agencies that are difficult or impossible to get, then we're basically saying you can't get flood insurance, and it's a pretty serious issue for landowners and the development community. This is something that we have been working on actively for the last year, and have brought some local governments into recently to help help us work with FEMA and the services to try to get to a workable result. It's not clear we're there yet, but this may be something this committee has some interest in the future in hearing more about, because it is a serious issue.
The other question I had with the new rule change is, I understand the jurisdictional both advantages and similarities to what Oregon already does. Do you know about the degree to which citizens can still bring private lawsuits in under the new rule?
So I'll give a general answer to that question, but then also invite Ms. Bensel or Mr. Garahan if they want to talk more. So citizen suits are allowed under the Clean Water Act for folks who discharge or fill without a permit. There are concerns out there that because of the clarification of when a permit is or is not required, that in a sense it'll be, if somebody violates those clear lines, it'll be easier to bring a lawsuit. I suppose in a hypothetical way there may be some truth to that, but it's sort of like saying if you've got a regulatory program that was so complicated and opaque that nobody knew what it required, nobody could effectively sue anybody, and we should continue that. I don't think that's how we should run the railroad. So while as a technical matter that may be true, the end result actually should be hopefully folks know what the rules are, they get a permit when it's required, and then we don't have lawsuits. The lawsuits will come only in cases where people don't respect those lines that have now been clarified.
Other questions? Representative McLean.
Richard, what states oppose the rule?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I'm actually going to let Mr. Garahan answer that question. There are a coalition of states that have filed several different lawsuits, and so it gets sort of complicated. So if you would, Mr. Garahan.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Paul Garahan, I'm the attorney in charge of the Natural Resources Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I don't have a list in front of me, but I'd be glad to pull that together and provide that to you. I know that there is a coalition of at least a dozen or more that have already participated in lawsuits opposed to the new rule.
May I follow?
Yeah, follow.
If you would, that'd be helpful. Who made the decision for Oregon to support the rule?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, the Attorney General approves any litigation that the state of Oregon enters into, and the Attorney General approved entering into this litigation. Without getting into details, that would be communications that are protected by attorney-client privilege. The standard process when frequently there are requests in environmental or natural resources matters like these from other states who are interested in getting involved, they ask their fellow attorneys general if they have any interest. We review the law, and we confer with our client agencies and the governor's office as appropriate to get policy input on the question at hand. That was done here, and the recommendation was made, and the attorney general approved joining a coalition of attorneys general who have intervened in the Court of Appeals challenge to the rule and have filed an amicus brief related to many of the district court challenges to the rule.
Yeah, if I'm right, I think it was in the 20s or 30s opposed and 12 or 13 in favor or something like that. I tried to Google it. I saw 22 suing it against, but I thought it was in that range and then another dozen or so the other direction potentially.
Chair Clem, that sounds about right, yeah. But I hesitate to say because I haven't looked at the specific numbers.
Yeah, Representative Klein.
Do you recall any of the names of the states who have joined our Attorney General's decision to support the advancement of regulation over waters in our states?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean. Washington State is also part of the coalition. The coalition is led by the Attorney General of New York. And then there are several other states, many of them East Coast states that are part of the coalition also.
Can you?
And I'd be happy to provide, I'd be happy to provide that list to you as well.
It would be helpful, Mr. Chairman, if we did have some understanding why Oregon has taken this position. While certainly we don't want to minimize what Mr. Whitman described as scientific-based decisions in opposition described as political, I think there might be useful for the legislative branch to evaluate what our sister branch is doing and what the Attorney General is doing with regards to this, given the nature of the impact upon the people of Oregon, which is significant. Now, I know regulating and advancing into people's, the government's regulatory powers, when extended and then clarified, may seem as a service or a gift to the people. But it could also be perceived as an advancement that is detrimental. So we are a check, and I think we should exercise that power.
Well, as you'll know, one of the reasons I'm having this hearing is because I thought, I saw an action by the other branches, and I wanted to get an explanation for background of the issue in general. But I did want to hear the state's reasoning, and I think Richard is largely described that the governor's office at least thinks it's got these advantages and these potential problems. Doesn't mean we can't go into it further, but that's why I wanted to have the hearing so we could take a look a little bit at the thinking of the state. I wasn't sure how much we could get or not because of our attorney-client privilege. But
well, and thank you for that. One follow-up for Richard. There was a federal appellate court case, I believe it was, that had determined that puddles on a logging road were not navigable, if I recall. Does the EPA, does this rule change that, or is that based upon does it overrule that, or at least I know this proposed change is subsequent to the court hearing, and I think Oregonians would be concerned about what is considered a discharge and what is considered navigable when it comes to a logging road.
So, Chair Clem, Representative McLean, two things. First of all, under the new rule that we just described, puddles are expressly excluded. I think you're referring to some prior litigation under not the Wetlands 404 program, but actually under the 402 discharge of a pollutant program that where the property owner and the state were sued for not issuing a permit for logging roads. And forget the how quickly we forget the plaintiff's name, but it was a lawsuit against prior state forester Marvin Brown. And in that case, the state defended the position that no permit was required all the way up to and through the Supreme Court successfully. So that broader issue about whether logging roads require a 402 permit has been answered definitively already by the Supreme Court.
And this rule wouldn't affect it?
No, it would not.
And finally, last thing, you've mentioned this rule change on the last that would be troubling based upon the proximity in almost a mile to a 100-year floodplain. Is this something that the Attorney General is continuing to advocate for, or are you just making a note that not all of the rules are necessarily celebrated?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I don't think this is really a legal point. I was making the policy point that you don't always get, in these processes, you don't always get everything that you would like to get. And this is one aspect of the rule that we will be watching very carefully how the federal agencies implement. And to the extent we see the federal agencies implementing this in a way that we think is inappropriate in the sense that it's pulling in wetlands or other waters that really do not have a significant effect on water quality. That's something that we certainly will engage the federal agencies with if they do go in that direction and we see problems being caused.
All right, thank you.
Okay, we're out of time. I know folks have meetings. Sorry, I went a little long early and then had to scramble, so there's no drought update for now, but I think we probably have some written materials on that. Mm-hmm. Thank you all for coming in to talk to us about this. I do appreciate, I had no basic understanding, and I certainly didn't understand the before and after the rule, so this is very helpful. Colleagues, what I just handed out to you is a summary of bills voted out of our committee and not enacted. And I thought that might be a good document for you to know as you think about February. I won't go into a lot of detail. Some of them have explanations, like the farm-to-school thing. We didn't enact the bill, but we did get the money, $3.5 million more. Other things like the ag incentive zone, I have no idea what happened to it. It went over there. We made more amendments, and then ended up dying. Beaver dams died. The Measure 49 thing died. So the rural tax credit went to revenue, didn't make it. Let's see. Our sort of brand Oregon thing never got funded. So anyway, this I just wanted to have you all get a sense of things we thought we had made good progress on, and some made it, and they're explicable why they're still on this list, and some didn't make it, and we might want to review these things again in the future. Anything else for the good of the order?
Mr. Chairman, how many committee bills does this committee have in the short session?
Three.
In
one member bill? So I think we got, or do we not know?
Two, I think. Is
two.
Right.
Okay.
In do you plan
which three of this list?
Well, I'm just curious. Is there any on there that you plan to do? Or are you going to hold that open for?
To be honest, I haven't read this yet either. So I'm open. to committee members, you know, you've used your own and or these were one of yours and you have a new idea, I'm open to suggestions from you on committee bills as well. I haven't, I don't think I've thought of any the new ideas that weren't on this list yet that we might want to use a committee bill for. I might be forgetting something, but right now I don't have a huge list myself of committee bills.
Well, I would think if there's any urgency that the short session is supposed to address budget and that which is very, very urgent.
Yeah, it'd be nice to get back to that model of the short Wouldn't session. It? Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate your patience. We probably should have started earlier, and if I had known I was going to be as bad at time management as I usually am, I would have. But thanks for your patience, and we'll adjourn the committee.